Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Chinese government announced today that it is ending its military drills surrounding Taiwan. However, Beijing also said further, quote, training and war preparation in and around the Taiwan Strait will continue. The Chinese military has been conducting live fire drills and missile launches in at least six zones circling Taiwan, an aggressive show of force following House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's controversial visit to the island last week. Pelosi defended her visit, saying it was, quote, absolutely worth it. At the same time, China issued a white paper today on its plans for Taiwan. It's been more than 20 years since Beijing last issued such a document. In the year 2000, the Chinese government promised not to land troops in Taiwan to force reunification. But today's white paper scrapped that promise. China will, quote, exert our utmost efforts to achieve peaceful reunification, the paper stated. Quote, but we will not renounce the use of force, and we reserve the option of taking all necessary measures, end quote. It's been an extraordinarily tense week in U.S.-China relations. China's openly aggressive live-fire drills have clearly demonstrated at least two things. One, an unyielding diplomatic tone designed to rattle the Taiwanese people and U.S. leadership. And perhaps more importantly, an open demonstration of the truth of China's current-day military might. So that's what we want to talk about today. What is the current size and sophistication of the Chinese military? What could China achieve if it launched an invasion of Taiwan, and how quickly? And does that material truth change the diplomatic and policy options available to the United States? Well, Oriana Schuyler-Mastro joins us. She's a fellow at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She's also author of The Costs of Conversations, Obstacles to Peace Talks in Wartime. Oriana, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So based on what you've seen over the past week and in, you know, even your observations, say, over the past year or two, if China launched an invasion of Taiwan and the U.S. attempted to intervene, could China possibly win that conflict?
The short answer is yes. There are conditions under which China could win a war, even with U.S. military intervention. Those conditions specifically are if China moves fast and hard, when the United States has very little early warning to respond. At this point, the Chinese strategists that I've read, that I've talked to, still think that the United States has some advantages in a more protracted conflict, So if it lasts, you know, months and months, years and years, but that's not the war that China is going to try to initiate. So when they take a move, they're going to do it in such a way that all the conditions are the most favorable to them.
So describe what you saw through your, you know, your analyst's eyes in terms of the live fire exercises that the Chinese military undertook in those, what, six plus zones encircling Taiwan. What exactly were they doing?
So there's a few things about those exercises that I think are important if you're interested in understanding where we are today and how different the Chinese military threat is. The first is to take a look at the last time we had a Taiwan Straits crisis, right? 1996, China conducted four rounds of live fire tests. There are very few similarities. I mean, what we look at today that they did with Taiwan makes that look like child's play, in addition to doing a number of missile tests. And back then, they never launched more than five or six missiles at a time. Now we're looking more at like nine or 11. They also included all components of their military. So we had 100 different aircraft, fighters, bombers, early warning aircraft, tankers, conducting all sorts of operations from air superiority to reconnaissance to ground assault. Then you also have the Navy component that was involved. You had 10 destroyers, allegedly submarines doing submarine exercises, an aircraft carrier. And all of these different components also encircled the island. Even the missiles went over the island to the other side, which was not the case in 1996. And they were all conducting relatively sophisticated exercises. We can see that they can now mobilize and move large amounts of their military and that they can conduct these things at the same time. However, there's still some uncertainty about the degree to which these elements were operating together. As an outside observer, I can't tell, for example, how closely they were in coordination with each other versus did they just get orders ahead of time, like be at this place, you know, at 9:32 a.m., versus they are actually coordinating in real time. And of course, this is an uncontested exercise, so it tells us something, but doesn't give us a complete picture of how the Chinese would be able to conduct, in this case, a blockade if they were actually met with force and resistance.
Okay, blockade. So we're going to talk about that a little later in the show. But so what you're saying, though, is clearly what you saw, or what the world essentially saw over the past week, was a completely different military organization, technologically and even sort of logistically, than what China had in, I guess, what we can call the last Taiwan Strait crisis from the mid-90s.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, their pilots, for example, in the 1990s, they couldn't navigate the roughly 40 miles off the coast to what we call the center line between China and Taiwan. And now, even before these exercises, that presence was consistent, like practically daily. Between September of 2020 and 2021, the PRC flew their aircraft into Taiwan's air defense identification zone about 250 days of that year, right? So you used to have pilots that couldn't fly at night, couldn't fly over water, and now you have them conducting these as routine operations. And in these exercises, for example, they were covering, you know, both exercises at night and at day. And those comparisons can be made for all of the services. They're, you know, if you look at their submarines or their surface ships, they had zero modern surface ships in 1999. Now, the majority of their surface ships are modern, and they have the largest navy in the world, even larger than the total number of ships that the U.S. Navy has. Though the U.S. Navy is still larger in tonnage, that just means they have heavier ships.
Wow. I'm going to come back to the detail that you can give us about the current state of essentially all the branches of the Chinese military. But for people who don't know, or perhaps weren't even alive during that last Taiwan Strait crisis in the mid-90s, remind us what triggered it and how was the U.S. involved? What exactly happened then?
So in the 1990s, the crisis was primarily triggered by Beijing's discontents with Taiwan domestic politics. So it's somewhat different than the crisis that was triggered today. In the 1990s, the number one concern that would lead us to war was that Taiwan, you know, might declare independence or go a different way. So in 1995, 1996, you had the first democratic election in Taiwan. And China was not particularly happy with this. Taiwan was not a democracy beforehand. It was actually a pretty brutal dictatorship. And so they were moving towards democracy. And China, through its missile tests, was trying to warn the people of Taiwan not to vote for a particular candidate. Now, the United States had sent an aircraft carrier strike group, then called a battle group, in the vicinity of Taiwan once before. It didn't work. The second time, we sent two. And after that, in March 1996, the Chinese stopped all of that military activity. So the United States' role was really to warn China, to deter China, to say to China, listen, we have the military power to shut this down, so you better cool it. And China did cool it. So that is sort of seen as a success story in the use of a diplomatic, of a military tool to achieve, you know, political goals. Now, the Chinese, you know, also had that same experience, but from their perspective, in 1996, they didn't have a lot of options. You know, the United States sails an aircraft carrier near you, you know, you stop what you're doing. But in the meantime, they developed the capabilities to sink an aircraft carrier. And I don't think that is coincidental. I think they primarily wanted to be able to keep the United States military out, and they wanted options to respond if the United States decided to use its military in the future to shape its choices.
So what you're saying is that, or is it fair to say that that mid-90s Taiwan Strait crisis, from China's perspective, was they decided to radically invest and modernize and expand their military?
Well, I think it was, I think that definitely highlighted some of those issues. It was a bit sooner, probably, you know, in the right before the crisis, that China sort of realized two big truths. The first one was its significant relative weakness, right? Compared to the United States military, and there was a lot of discussion, you know, after the Gulf War, the Chinese looked at what the United States military was capable of, in particular using precision-guided munitions, you know, hitting a lot of targets exactly where we wanted to hit them. And China thought, wow, you know, we are really, really, really far behind. They had this theory that the sort of spirit of the Chinese people could overcome the technological advances of their adversaries. And they came to the conclusion that, you know, well, this technology is too advanced. So they knew they were relatively weak. And they also thought and came to the realization that the greatest threat to their ambitions was basically the United States, that only the United States could stand in the way of their goals of what they refer to as national rejuvenation now, and in particular, unification with Taiwan. And so what followed then was basically a complete transformation, both in equipment that sort of came first. Defense spending rose by 740%, and they invested on getting that modern equipment. And then under Xi Jinping, since 2013, a lot of the focus has been actually on organizational reform, more realistic exercises to make sure that the people can actually perform in the way that they should.
Well, we're talking today about what the current state of the Chinese military actually is, how much it's changed in the past 20 years or so, and what that means for the diplomatic options that the United States has regarding U.S. interests in the Pacific Rim. Oriana Skylar-Mastro joins us. We'll have more in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're trying to get a detailed understanding of the current capacity of the Chinese military. And later on in the show, we're going to talk about what that means for diplomatic and political options in Washington, given that military reality in Beijing. And I'm joined today by Oriana Skylar-Mastro. She's a longtime China observer, fluently speaks Chinese. She's also a fellow at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She's author of The Costs of Conversation, Obstacles to Peace Talks in Wartime, and in fact teaches a class on the Chinese military at Stanford. Now, Oriana, what I'd love is to sort of walk through some of the services a little bit and hear from you sort of a comparison of what China's capable of now versus what the United States is, just to get a sense as to how we understand what the Chinese military fully looks like. So let's talk about missiles, first of all, because I believe you've said that China might currently outclass some of the U.S. capabilities in hypersonic missiles? Tell me more.
So China has the most advanced cruise and ballistic missile program in the world. So these are sort of two main types of missiles that primarily differ on their trajectory, the pathway that they travel. So ballistic missiles, their trajectory, they go through space and then come back down. And when they come back down, they're going very quickly, you know, because they're coming through space. And so they're hard to defeat that way. Cruise missiles actually skim pretty close to the Earth's surface. And so they can be hard to defeat because radars see them at the last minute because of the horizon. So they're just two different classes of missiles. And then hypersonics, they have these boost glide vehicles that basically allow the missile to go faster. And they're more maneuverable, so they're coming closer to the Earth's surface, and they're moving around, and they have longer range. So those are particularly difficult for any missile defense to defeat. So a lot of China's missiles, one, they're extremely precise. Like we saw in the last in these exercises that just occurred around Taiwan, that all the missiles that China tested landed where China planned for them to land. And they also can do some very sophisticated things like hit moving ships at sea. So they have a missile primarily designed, it's called the aircraft carrier, to hit an aircraft carrier. And this is particularly difficult to hit something that's moving at sea. The United States doesn't have this capability, an anti-ship ballistic missile. I think because our focus is not the same as China's, right? We don't have large amounts of ships operating close to our shores, so it's never been a priority. So in addition to the sophistication of the missiles, they also have a lot of them, right? They have thousands of these short-range ballistic missiles. So these are the ones that are more in the range of like Taiwan and Japan. And then they have a couple hundred medium-range ballistic missiles. Intermediate-range ballistic missiles is where a lot of their capabilities lie. And the United States doesn't have any of these because of a treaty that we had with the Soviet Union and then Russia during the Cold War, though President Trump scrapped the INF treaty so we could develop similar capabilities. And then, of course, there's ICBMs that deliver nuclear weapons and can deliver nuclear weapons to the United States. So their missile capabilities is one of the things that's a primary threat against U.S. basing in the region. When people talk about concerns that China, for example, could take out the U.S. bases in Japan, primarily Kadena, which is the main air base for any Taiwan contingencies where the United States would operate from, it is with missiles because China has a lot of them. Missile defenses, we say they're easily saturated. What that means is just that they can only defend against a certain number of missiles. So if you just shoot a little bit more than that number, they're bound to get through. Mm-hmm. And so those so that's primarily how we think China would take out that base in Japan.
Okay. But just again, for context, America's nuclear capability remains extremely sophisticated and terribly deadly.
Absolutely. Yeah. And nuclear modernization is one of the last of the Chinese modernizations. So, for example, the United States has like 5,800 nuclear weapons at this point, while China, you know, has a few hundred. There's estimates between like 220, 350. And there's also limitations in launchers. I mean, we talk about number of missiles, but it's kind of like talking about bullets, but not talking about how many guns you have. Mm-hmm. Like the launchers are what really gets them over. And I think it's important, Magna, to point out that China has no conventional capability against the United States. All of these missiles that we're talking about, the ICBMs, obviously nuclear capable, can reach the United States. But all the other missiles we're talking about can only, you know, hit targets in the region. And China doesn't have the capabilities with aircraft, with surface, you know, ships, with anything to attack the United States. Yes. With conventional systems.
Yeah, but that's a point well taken, Oriana. But of course, the most likely place a U.S.-China conflict would happen would be in the region, right? I mean, around Taiwan. So what about, you know, I'm thinking about how a modern war would be waged. What about artificial intelligence?
So artificial intelligence, I think, is really important because it changes a lot of Chinese perceptions of their capabilities. In the United States, we are thinking about including, you know, AI into military systems, but we feel more comfortable having a human in the loop. We don't like the idea that machines would make decisions for us. But Chinese strategic thinking is completely different. AI allows them to do two things. The first is that their military personnel are not as well trained as ours. They have an average now of a ninth grade education. It used to be a sixth grade education previously. They haven't fought a war since 1979. They're extremely controlling, as you can imagine, in a communist system. So unlike our military, where a commander, you know, might tell an officer, you know, I want you to take this hill, and then the officer can decide how to do it. You know, in the Chinese system, it's extremely stovepipe that the leaders have to make those decisions. So the Chinese are concerned about the capabilities of their personnel. If they can use AI-enabled systems and take the person out of the loop, that makes them more confident in their military capabilities. The second thing about AI is that the Chinese have this concept of war control, in which they believe that if you just really think through, you can plan and prepare for every possible outcome and contingency in a war. You can modulate its pace, you can determine when it ends, and obviously, you know, machine learning, big data, AI, that kind of algorithmic warfare is exactly what they have in mind. They think if we just have the right systems, we can predict and ensure victory ahead of time. So from my perspective, AI is really significant because of how much confidence, more confidence, it would give the Chinese in their ability to win a war, even if technologically, whatever the technological aspects are, those are sort of separate from the strategic changes.
So we've talked about AI. Missiles. Earlier, you mentioned major developments over the past couple of decades in the Chinese Navy and in their Air Force capabilities. So, you know, I've been focusing essentially on equipment, but you also mentioned organization. And I mean, what about actual just troops, the people who would be waging a war in Taiwan if China invaded? What's the capacity organizationally and troops-wise in the Chinese military?
So, you know, China has, you know, one of the largest militaries in the world. There's about 2 million members of the Chinese military. Most of them are still in the army. Almost a million of them are in the army, with much smaller amounts in the Navy and the Air Force. China still has a conscript system, so about, you know, 700,000 are conscripts. So they're just coming in for a shorter period of time, you know, 18 months, 2 years. Some of them choose to stay, but not all of them do. And then they have a separate force, the People's Armed Police, which was kind of a deal that the Communist Party made with the PLA after Tiananmen, when the military said, you know, okay, we know a big part of our job is to be loyal to the Communist Party and ensure the stability of the Communist Party, but we're not particularly happy about killing Chinese people. So can you give that, you know, the majority of that mission to someone else? So the People's Armed Police was set up to do that. Now, the individuals in this military are, as I mentioned, it's, you know, of a lower education level. It's been very difficult for the Chinese to recruit college graduates, for example. It's improved in recent years, but they've never hit their recruitment targets. And they're primarily concerned about developing a non-commissioned officer corps. So this is one of the strengths of the United States military, is within our enlisted ranks, we have non-commissioned officers that are really the backbone of our military. And so when the Chinese would come to the United States for military-to-military exchanges, for example, they were more interested in seeing how we trained or enlisted in some cases than taking a look at a fancy aircraft, because it was so important to them. The individuals also, I mean, there's just so many controls on them in terms of what they could do. I remember there was, you know, a story about certain units not being able to have cell phones, for example. Even after you get married, you still live in the barracks. Being a member of the Chinese military is not great, and that's what Xi Jinping has been trying to improve. When they say that a lot of the money of their budget increases are going to personnel, I mean, that's partially true. They're trying to improve the lifestyle of those people in order to recruit more people to join the forces.
So, Oriana, you've painted quite a sobering picture here about China's military capabilities in 2022. But at the same time, the United States, you know, spends more on its military than any other country in the world by far. We have military bases around the world, an extremely highly trained military, as you just pointed out, ships, submarines, equipment, etc., ready for deployment at a moment's notice. And yet I heard you say earlier that in a short, sharp invasion scenario, that China could potentially overwhelm U.S. capability in the region and even take out U.S. bases. I mean, is it really as serious as that?
So I think the issue here is that the United States would be fundamentally fighting a different war than what China would be fighting. So even though the U.S. military is more capable, it's somewhat irrelevant. So I'll give you sort of a comparison with the war in Ukraine right now. We're looking at Ukraine using javelins against Russian tanks. And it's interesting to me that we think China should learn lessons from Russia. But the better comparison is that the United States is Russia. Like, we're the ones with this big equipment. China's the ones with the javelins, right, in that sort of comparison. That's why they have what we call anti-access area denial capabilities. They need one missile that costs, you know, a few million dollars to take out billions of dollars of aircraft carriers. So what they are, they're just planning for a different type of conflict. And most of U.S. systems are actually not in Asia. Right. Even the ones assigned to Indo-Pacific Command, many of those are homeported, you know, back in California and San Diego or other places where I am right now. And so the way the United States fights wars, as we have in the past, is we have the time to amass all of our forces in theater. So we move all of our forces, we move all of our stuff, right? The munitions, the fuel. We get it all in place. We send our aircraft to take out the air defense systems of our adversary so that we can fly freely and safely, right? In Afghanistan, in Iraq, you know, there was no dog fighting, right? No one was up there with us. We were by ourselves, you know, safe. Even if you saw Top Gun Maverick, you know, I was the annoying person turning to my husband being like, we would never bring an aircraft carrier that close to China. You know, this is not the way we should be fighting wars. So the problem is that China knows how we fight wars. And so their view is just don't let the United States bring all that stuff in. Don't give them time to do it. And, you know, for example, there was a RAND study that said if you did have dogfighting, if you had fighters, China versus the United States shoots down 13 Chinese aircraft for every one they shoot down of ours. So what China learned from that is just put holes in their runways so they can't take off. Then we don't have to deal with the fact that they are more capable. Just blind them in space so they can't talk to each other, so they can't move stuff into theater. So that's why we refer to China's strategy as asymmetric, because they've basically identified the key nodes of the U.S. military, and they can take those out so they don't have to deal with the ways that we are so capable.
Well, Oriana Skylar Mastro is with us today, and she's giving us a sobering and detailed survey of China's current military capacity, specifically in the region and around Taiwan. So let's take a moment to listen to what Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu said on CNN just yesterday.
If you ask me, I worry a little bit.
What do you worry about?
I worry that China may really launch a war against Taiwan. But what it is doing right now is trying to scare us. And the best way to deal with it, to show to China that we are not scared.
That's Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu. And here's President Biden on Monday when reporters asked him how worried he is about the situation in the Taiwan Straits.
How worried are you about the situation in Taiwan? Because China is kind of keeping a bit of a grip around the whole island now.
I'm not worried, but I'm concerned that they're moving as much as they are. But I don't think they're going to do anything wrong.
Can you get with the live move of the speaker to go to Taiwan?
That was her decision.
That was President Biden on Monday. Well, joining us now is Bonnie Lin. She's director of the China Power Project and senior fellow for Asian Security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And from 2015 to 2018, she served in the office of the Secretary of Defense as former director for Taiwan and country director for China and a senior advisor as well. Bonnie Lin, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
We are heading towards our next break here, so let me just first ask you, based on what you've heard Oriana describe, do you think it changes the calculus of what diplomatic and military options are realistic for Washington to consider in handling tensions around Taiwan?
If I could just quickly push back a little bit on Oriana's characterization of China's ability to quickly achieve success in Taiwan invasion, I think that is not far from guaranteed because, as you know, an amphibious invasion is one of the most complex and difficult operations. Even though China has significant equipment, it's still quite far away in terms of training of its joint operations. I would also note that if we take a lesson and China takes a lesson from Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there should be more doubt not only in the PLA's assessment of its ability to conduct such operations, but also she should doubt the PLA's capabilities.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, Bonnie Lin, I'm going to hear a lot more from you when we come back, and Oriana Schuyler-Mastro from you as well. We're trying to get a sense of what China's actual military capabilities are right now, given those live fire exercises that the Chinese military undertook over the past week around Taiwan, and how that changes diplomatic, political, and military options for the United States as well. More in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand, in as much detail as we can, the current state of the Chinese military, its level of sophistication, its capacity, especially in the region around Taiwan. And of course, we're wondering that because of those live fire drills that the Chinese military has undertaken in the past week. Last Tuesday, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby had this measured response to those live fire drills.
The president wants to keep those lines of communication open. It is particularly important to do that when there's times of tension like right now. So I would say, to answer your question, one, we don't want to see this spiral into any kind of a crisis or conflict. Again, we would say there's no reason to. Number two, we want to be able to maintain those lines of communication. But a lot of this is going to depend on how China behaves over coming days and weeks.
But of course, by the end of the week last week, many of those lines of communications were closed. Then on Monday, Defense Undersecretary Colin Kall held a briefing with reporters at the Pentagon, and he said the U.S. believes China is trying to coerce Taiwan and the international community, but the U.S. will not, quote, take the bait.
It's a manufactured crisis. That doesn't mean we have to play into that. I think it would only play to Beijing's advantage. What we'll do instead is to continue to fly, to sail, and to operate wherever international law allows us to do so, and that includes in the Taiwan Strait. And we will continue to stand by our allies and partners in the region. And I think there's a lot of confidence in that U.S. commitment.
We're joined today by Oriana Schuyler-Mastro. She's a fellow at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, author of The Costs of Conversation, Obstacles to Peace in Wartime. Bonnie Lin is also with us. She's director of the China Power Project and senior fellow for Asian Security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and from 2015 to 2018 served as the former director for Taiwan in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Now, Bonnie, before the break, you were telling us about areas in which you have a very different view about China's current military capability. Tell us more. Where else do you not see quite eye to eye with Oriana about what China could do now if it indeed decided to invade Taiwan?
So I think what's important to point out is that even if China has more confidence and more military capabilities, it doesn't. China has had very little real-world experience, and it's far from guaranteed when engaging in one of the most complex operations that China will succeed. And pulling this back to what we're seeing presently right now, I think it's important to point out that China did, what we saw from its military exercises were that it was carefully orchestrated to actually try to minimize escalation, both against the United States and against Taiwan. So we don't see as much reporting on this, but we know that China did not send any aircraft into Taiwan's airspace or any vessels into Taiwan's territorial waters. At the same time, China did not start its unprecedented military exercises until Speaker Pelosi has already left. All of these activities show that even as China's military power increases, it is very careful to avoid escalation against the United States and even against Taiwan, which, as Oriana pointed out, is significantly weaker than China. China is still cautious to not try to escalate what we saw happen into an open conflict.
Oriana, would you like to respond?
Well, I completely agree with Bonnie. I mean, one of the things, the conditions under which China could possibly win are ones in which there's an element of surprise. And so I was never concerned that these exercises were going to spiral or escalate into a full-fledged war. I mean, it's not the right time before the Party Congress. And China doesn't want to do it when all eyes are on Taiwan. So I also agree with Bonnie that they haven't fought a war since 1979. There are some insecurities in the Chinese system about their ability to perform. That's why Xi Jinping has emphasized the need for more realistic exercises before they move. So my primary concern about this round of exercises, and China has announced there are more to come, and I predict that they'll try to normalize a higher level of activity now around Taiwan, is that they're going to get that practice in. Now that they have this higher operational tempo that could give them that confidence that Bonnie, you know, absolutely lays out, they should be in some doubt about their capability to launch a large-scale amphibious assault. But the more that they get to exercise it, the more they get to hone certain capabilities, I'm concerned the more they become confident they'll be able to do it.
So let's thread in then what we need to understand from that white paper that Beijing also issued, what, just today, because the last one was, as I said earlier, more than two decades ago. And in this latest statement, just to reiterate, Beijing said they will not renounce the use of force and reserve the option of taking all necessary measures. And I think even more interestingly, the white paper said that the problem of Taiwan was not something that they wanted to extend into the next generation. So, Bonnie, I mean, how clear of an indication is that from Beijing about whether or not eventually, perhaps, I don't know, in the next 2, 5, 10 years, that a forceful invasion of Taiwan may actually happen?
Really, really great question. And I would encourage folks to read the white paper yourselves because it's such an important document. And exactly like you mentioned, coming at a critical time right when China ended its military exercise. It's meant to articulate the current Chinese position on Taiwan, as well as set the foundations of what we may see as potential changes in Xi Jinping's policy on Taiwan after the 20th Party Congress. In terms of the most major changes, the point that you highlighted that China does not renounce the use of force against Taiwan, that's actually not new. Mm. And it was present even in the 1990s. China has never renounced the use of force. What I would note is that I don't see any signals in this new white paper that says that China has accelerated its timeline for unification, or any signals in China's white paper that says that China is accelerating any plans to use military force against Taiwan. If anything, one of the main things to focus on is that the paper says that national development and progress set the direction for cross-strait relations. What that means is China still believes that time is on its side And as China becomes more or more powerful, it will have more tools to achieve unification with Taiwan. So in other words, Xi Jinping and Beijing is not saying China needs to move on Taiwan now or in 2 years. He is saying that we're becoming more powerful, have confidence in China, and we will resolve this issue.
We will resolve this issue, but not saying how that resolution may come about.
Right. It doesn't specify it has to occur through military means. In fact, it still says China's main goals are to achieve peaceful unification.
Right. Well, Oriana, same question to you. I'd love to understand how you read this latest white paper.
So one thing is, and Bonnie is, knows this probably more than I do, but one thing about the Chinese is you always have to read between the lines of what they say. I had a conversation recently with some Chinese government officials in which they said, our policy is still peaceful reunification. And I pushed back on that and I said, well, we've seen the data, right? You've done this peaceful reunification thing for a while. I think the last polling, it was like 4% of the people of Taiwan would consider being a part of China. You can't possibly think this is working. And I've read, I've written a lot about the internal debate about how many people in China say it's not working. And the response I got from Chinese government officials was, well, it's peaceful reunification backed by significant military force. What I've started to realize is that their strategy of peaceful reunification is changing. It used to be political and economic ties would lead to this attractiveness of China for Taiwan, and then Taiwan would want to be a part of China. Now, my concern is that they think with this overwhelming military force, if they sort of show their latent power, Taiwan and the people of Taiwan will realize that they don't stand a chance. So peaceful reunification is really a way of just saying, like, surrender and acquiesce to China. And I'm not a Taiwan domestic politics expert, but my view is that probably the people of Taiwan are not going to give in to that unless there's Chinese boots on the ground on the island. And that's why I think it's hard for me to fathom a scenario in which China achieves its goals without using force.
Bonnie, go ahead, respond to that.
Sure. I largely agree with Oriana, and I think where some of the differences is maybe on how China uses force, because I think both of us agree that China is already using force against Taiwan on a daily basis. Even before the most recent exercises, we saw China engaging in almost daily intrusions into Taiwan's air defense identification zone. I think the main debate that folks have in DC about how China may use force against Taiwan is, does China need to engage in a significant large show of force, like a blockade or like an invasion? Or can China use more lower level activities that start coercing Taiwan, not only through military means, but through political economic means, and achieve those same aims? What's interesting, super interesting about the recent military exercises is they're not a blockade, but they have effects that are starting to rise up to the level of a blockade effect, right? Causing commercial and air traffic as well as maritime traffic to reroute, basically encircling Taiwan. In some ways, we have seen China elevate what we typically called gray zone activities to include this recent exercise. So moving forward, a main question or discussion to understand is, can China move forward with significant activities like the scale that are short of a full blockade and short of a full-scale invasion?
Okay, so then on that point, bringing our focus back to Washington, given whatever the most important agreements are between the United States and Taiwan, let's go down the blockade scenario here. If a more formalized, hardened blockade formed around Taiwan and China did so, would that be enough to pull the U.S. into a military conflict there?
I think it will depend on the specific U.S. leader, but a formal blockade is a declaration of war. Mm-hmm. And it will depend on how the particular U.S. leader respond to that. But I would say, given the bipartisan consensus for support for Taiwan and support for competition with China, I would be surprised if the United States did not respond.
So what does that mean, Bonnie? I mean, did not respond. What are the potential response options that the U.S. would have?
Of course, there are a couple of response options. It could be breaking the blockade. So, for example, using our military to escort ships through the blockaded areas. It could mean using our aircraft to break the air blockade, because, as you know, a blockade can involve multiple elements. It might not just be a maritime blockade. It could also be an air blockade, but also an information blockade. We could also consider, depending on the nature of the blockade, airlifting resources to Taiwan. Those would be the most direct in terms of breaking the blockade. We would also likely could offer support below that, including intelligence to the Taiwan side, so they could engage in operations on their own. And of course, beyond the military realm, we would be likely rallying the international community to push back against China's increased provocation. And likely how we would characterize it would be unprovoked Chinese provocation and escalation against Taiwan.
Oriana, respond to that, because to my ear, and granted, it's not an expert ear, but it sounds like the United States actually may have limited options, none of which are good.
So in a blockade scenario, our options are better than an amphibious assault because it gives the United States time. I think the United States, as the clip from Colin Call pointed out, is going to fly and sail wherever international law allows, which means we would absolutely go against the blockade rules and put the burden on China to shoot us down or to sink us. You know, so then it's up to China. Do you want to start a war with the United States? I think airlifting and supplies, escorting ships would definitely be on the menu. The United States would also start flowing forces and pre-positioning in the region, right, just in case this escalated to a full-fledged war. And that's not in China's interests. If the United States can fight a war the way we like to fight a war, that's when the United States wins. That's why I see a blockade scenario is quite risky if the ultimate goal is unification. An amphibious assault, on the other hand, you know, it's risky because, as Bonnie pointed out, it's a difficult operation. But once I think China has boots on the ground, they're never going to leave. And even with those risks, people always point out, you know, to Normandy and how costly Normandy was, to highlight that China might not want to take those risks. But the bottom line is we did it, right? Mm. Even though we knew Normandy was going to be costly and the German defenses in comparison, were far more significant than the defense that Taiwan could put up. When it was so important to us, we did it. And that's what my concern is. Of course, there's going to be costs, but if it's so important to China, they might take similar risks.
Well, we're wrapping up this conversation. And Bonnie, the last question goes to you. So given all that we've heard from both you and Oriana this hour, I think I'd like to understand as deeply as possible what you think Washington, both the Pentagon, but more importantly, the State Department and the White House, how they should manage or navigate U.S.-China-Taiwan relations over the next couple of years, because it does feel as if we're in an extraordinarily sensitive moment.
We are definitely in an extraordinarily sensitive moment, and potentially a moment, like Oriana pointed out, in which China is trying to set a new normal where China can operate with, so far, limited impunity closer to Taiwan. So as we move forward, I think a couple of things we need to focus on and pay attention to. One is, how do we balance supporting Taiwan with activities that might be perceived by the Chinese side as additional provocations or increasing the escalation risk? So what we saw in terms of the U.S. response to date to the Chinese military exercise is right now an erring on the side of not allowing China to act out, but not necessarily encouraging China to escalate. Hmm.
Well, Bonnie Lin, director of the China Power Project and senior fellow for Asian Security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Oriana.
Thank you, Magna.
Yeah, Oriana Schuyler Mastro, fellow at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies and non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, also of the costs of conversation, obstacles to peace talks in wartime. Oriana, it was great to have you back. Thank you.
Of course.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.